chemical process which has been given to us through this lineage and is practiced in truth in the retreat process, which often is not, we don't have the opportunity in our community to here in Kansas City to practice that, but I know that again some of my students have had that opportunity and certainly willing to offer that if there is the call. But the process is an alchemical process of six phases, and one of the phases is when we begin the journey. And beginning the journey is to take oneself into a kind of accountability and look at what it is that we are wishing to accomplish during this process of transformation, the alchemical process, which to the Sufis means transforming the dross of the personality into the gold of the soul. And so it's, a metaphor is often given for the arc of ascent and descent. In other words, a metaphor also could be given to climbing a mountain and a kind of arduous journey that one's on when one is climbing, scaling a great mountain, the energy and effort that it takes. So the first is kind of at base camp, just sort of taking inventory. The word that the Sufis give for this is muhasabi. Or it could be, even in Islamic terms, jihad. The great holy war. But the great holy war is within, with that ego. And then as one starts to ascend the mountain, one enters into the second phase of the alchemical process. And here's where the journey actually begins, of elevating one's consciousness with a great emptiness, this aspect of not mine, but thine. And also, clear mind, don't know, as the Buddhists say. So an emptying out. Sometimes there is, again, another metaphor that's associated with this process. This would be the empty moon, the new moon. You can go through this process if you just turn inward. The third phase is going higher yet. This is said to be the immaculate state, where one is looking out on a landscape that is pure and untainted. It could be likened to a landscape purely fallen snow without any trace or tracking. This would be the attunement to the Blessed Virgin Mary. This pure state, a virginal state, an immaculate state, where one has been cleansed. But there's caution here, because if one lingers too long, one can tip into the dark night of the soul. It is that empty. It is that vast. One goes higher still, reaching the zenith, the apex of the mountain, the fourth stage, union with beloved. God is love, lover of beloved. Thou that art, so am I. The fifth stage of that process is beginning a descent down the mountain. This is where the power comes in. One starts to actually see and experience oneself reformed in the image of their soul. And just as descending a mountain, the pace is quickened because the gravity is pulling us, so too this phase is a very quick phase, quickening, a quickening within one's being to re-emerge after having gone through this journey. And the final phase is the sixth phase, where one moves completely forward in one's life in this realization of the nobility of the soul. This feeling of one's true nobility, true birthright. Where the glory of God shines forth through our beings. But this process can happen in a day, can happen in a few days, and some of us have participated in this process for month, 2 months, 3 months. It is a very inner transformation that one can undergo, and it is a journey inward. It is a very helpful process in the aspect of self-realization. That's ultimately the goal that Sufism is taking us towards. First, we have this feeling of the desire to know God. But beyond that, I assure you, there's something more. It's the desire to know oneself. And the self is God. It is divine. So God realization is only half the journey. Ultimately, one has to come into the world in self-realization. Comments or questions before we move on.
Yes, a question from Alina Petra. I'm not sure which word. Alina, you mentioned that there was a word you asked for me to write down, but I don't know which word that was. The word that you used with the first phase, the Sufi word for jaha,
Mahasabhi, M-A-H-A-S-A-B-I, Mahasabhi. And one could translate that word. You know, the beauty of using some of these words is they're very powerful words. You know, sometimes we in English takes many words to explain something, but these words, these sacred names, or this would be a terminology for sort of an aspect of us going through the stages of realization. And what it means is taking oneself into account. Mahasabhi is taking oneself into account, is what it means. You know, it's really interesting what we do, and I think this relates to this teaching, training the ego, the animal side of man's ego, because what often happens is instead of taking ourselves into account for something, we can possibly, I'm not saying anyone in this room does it or on our Skype chat, but we've seen it done Sometimes it happens in places of business, sometimes it happens in families, sometimes it happens amongst friends. If someone feels they've been wrong, rather than looking at oneself and saying, what is arising here? What can be benefited from this? Is there a lesson that I can learn? Looking at one's reaction, maybe if someone precipitated this within another person. I'm not saying it's always that way. It can absolutely be through the confusion of mind of another, but nonetheless, we can look at ourselves. That's mahasabhi. But often what happens, instead of doing that, which can calm ourselves so we can see clearly the course of action, we spend a lot of time gathering forces, like telling the story to others, trying to get other people on our side, trying, again, there's that self-consciousness that draws someone in saying, you know what, that was really wrong, you were right, I can understand how you feel. You know, we do that. We want that kind of assurance, and we see it in education amongst a student. Perhaps the student isn't performing well, then they become angry with the professor, then they want to get other students involved. It can happen amongst our peers, our colleagues. This is a fact of life, but this is also animalistic. It's like a pack mentality where, you know, you're running with the pack and then you see the little weak gazelle out there and you like want to tear it apart and you get everybody else to help you. It's just so strange, isn't it, when you think of it that way? But that's what it really is. Was having a discussion recently because there are always these issues about women in business or women in spiritual communities, et cetera, et cetera. The subject came up, we were at the Federation of the Message where the different Sufi leadership and also some murids from, meaning students from different Sufi organizations gathered for an inter-order meeting and retreat together. And there was a lot of sharing and talking from things from different esoteric schools, and it was a wonderful experience. But one of the things that did come up was, that there's sometimes an underrepresentation of women within the spiritual hierarchy. And so what we also see in business, as well as sometimes, I don't see it so much in our Sufi movement, I'll say that, but in some other organizations, it can clearly be highlighted. And I'm not faulting anybody. It's just as things have emerged. It is no fault. Perhaps the women have been busy with families, and then they are ready to emerge, and there's just a pattern that's set up. So, again, I'm not finding fault. I'm just observing what we've seen, and I'm also recounting what was talked about. But here's the deal. There can also be a distrust among women where they don't support each other. And to me, again, it gets back to this animal side of our ego, and it comes to do, you know, clear back, if you can trace it back, it has to do with reproductivity, choosing mates, not, strutting our stuff. If we sometimes get envious of someone that we think has something we don't, or looks a way that we don't, it is a very interesting thing. And we ladies really need to be aware of that and support each other and love each other and honor each other and not compete with each other. There is enough of this in the world. This is really important for women to understand because we want to often blame the men for it, but we ourselves do it in subtle or not so subtle ways to each other. So those ladies that are here and also online, let's come together and support each other. And people want to say, women can be the worst gossips and say the worst things about each other. Don't participate. Say, Bismillah, let's begin in the name of God. Alhamdulillah, let's praise God. Don't need to do it to each other. We don't need to put that vibration out. And men, I always tell my men students at the college to give their full attention and support to the women when they're presenting things. This is part of your character also. Jungians would say it's your anima. If you disrespect the outer feminine, you are not connected with your inner feminine. It's very important. I'm preaching to the choir here, I know, but we can carry this, we can be representatives of this in our communities, in our families, with our friends. Does that make sense?
Yes, even with the other kids, it's such a competitive culture.
Yes.
And they're just so indoctrinated into it, they don't even realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. But we can help. And we don't have to participate in that way. We don't have to participate in that dance. And I know that everyone here is not participating in it, but we can help others because there's that tendency in well, the animal side of our nature. Exactly. I want to get Leo going.
I just read the coyotes, when they raise their families, they raise them with their sisters. So there's the alpha female and then all of her sisters, and they all stay together. And the alpha gives birth, and all the sisters together raise the coyotes, unless they're being killed. Then a sister would start to give birth too. So it's a really female oriented culture. I haven't even heard anything about the males in it yet. Interesting. So that orangutan compared to the coyotes. It's just interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I'll just note this as well. Because I've been reading this book, and of course, the reason we didn't have our class last month was because we were hosting the visiting scholar from Morocco. And one of the things that the college did, many people at the college, they read a book, which is available in the bookstore, it's also available online, by a female writer in Morocco. She's Moroccan. She's writing about Moroccan life, and her name is Fatima Meranisi. And she wrote the book called Dreams of Trespass, Memoirs of a Harem Girl, I think is what it said. And it's very interesting how these women writers in these cultures are using this kind of storytelling to convey the social, political, cultural dimension of life. It's you know, it's hard to put someone in prison for telling a story, you know. But it is very much struck at the heart of trying to convey what's going on. Now, interestingly enough, the harem isn't what we think of it. The harem is exactly what you described. It's the women of the family all living together, keeping the family together, raising the children, and typically the alphas would be the senior women of the family, like the grandmothers. And also, if for some reason a woman, they use the word in Islam at least, and I do want to say that Morocco was not, they had their own indigenous religious practices. I mean, Islam was a more recent event, but it's become an emphasis within the religious impulse there. But there's a lot of Catholics even from France that relocated there. So it's a multicultural, multi-religious environment. But this cultural context of keeping the families together in huge households, if a woman becomes repudiated, which would be divorced by her husband, which is a big humiliation, she has nowhere to go. She often will lose her children. The man has the right to keep them. The law has changed a little bit, but it's slow. Then this woman is left with nothing. So she will then be brought into this household also to be taken care of. So that's this concept of harem, which is a little bit different than our concept. And so it's a very, it's a really interesting dynamic in it. So Fatima Meranisi is telling this story from her point of view, being a female child, or her childhood memories of all these relationships, which really focus primarily on the women in her family, the grandmothers, the aunts, you know, and sort of the family that lived in the rural area versus the people that lived in the city, in the Medina, which is the marketplace, which is much more conservative than the people in the country. It's a very interesting, if you want some insights into the culture and sort of that family interaction, it's a good book, and it's nice to read. I mean, it's just kind of it's very pleasant, but then at the same time, it has these real important messages in it. And she's also talking about the dynamic of the kind of the doorway of the home as being a frontier. Even the veil is a frontier. And she's likening that to, in the 50s, that experience of the French were there, the Spanish were there, Moroccan independence was coming, and then the next thing that was coming was this whole independence movement of the women that were very involved in, you know, Moroccan independence movement. So it's interesting, and these give us real insights into those kinds of cultural dynamics that we can only imagine or think up if we haven't lived there or experienced it in some way. She gives us good insight. But I brought that up because it relates, I think, to your subject of these coyotes, because even though in one way it's a patriarchal society internally in that family unit, it's very matriarchal. Very interesting. The training of the ego, the animal side of man's ego. There is a side of man's ego which may be called the animal side. And yet, it is worse than an animal side. For there are tamed animals which have a tendency to love and to respond to love, and which are harmless. But there is a part of man's nature which may be likened to a thorn or the horn of a rhinoceros. And this ego takes pleasure in hurting others and gets joy from giving pain. From a scientific point of view, this is called mania or disease. But psychologically speaking, all that is below the human ideal is a defect in man which he could overcome if he knew how. Again, from a scientific point of view, this is called mania or disease. But psychologically speaking, all that is below the human ideal is a defect in man which he could overcome if he knew how. I'll depart here from the reading for a moment. This also has to do with, from a very, again, from a scientific materialistic point of view, it can be something as simple as repatterning your brain. So if you always pick up your glass with your right hand, try for 1 week making yourself think about picking it up with the left hand. This is breaking a habit. If the impulse is to, you know, do this, shake one's foot up and down, make it be still. One can talk about this, and I'm sure Karima Gita, Terry, and I also do with my students. Our brain is wired for survival. We think we're very sophisticated and, you know, noble in our own way because we stand on our 2 feet and, you know, this thumb works. And we have speech. But in truth, our brain is still pretty primitive. And so, as I said, it's wired for survival. And in order to survive, one has to do things repetitively really well. But that is the antithesis of being a fully functioning, fully awake human being, and it is certainly the antithesis of creativity. So if we have the pattern to do something the same way all the time, we need to try to change it. This is why the alternate nostril breathing is good. This is why mothers that have babies should let them crawl until they pull themselves up themselves, because it keeps that brain, that cross-crawl movement, helps develop both hemispheres of the brain. This is why it's really good to try to develop this kind of balance within our bodies and not be dominant in with one hand. You know, try practicing writing with your non-dominant hand. Try other things that are bringing about a better balance. These are very simple things. They can be, you know, if you always brush your teeth with your right hand again, try with your left hand. It's going to feel weird, but it does things to the circuitry in the brain. It trains us a different way. These are very simple things that can help us to overcome habitual patterns. We can do it with a simple thing. We can do it with other things. Back to the reading. Often a man is seen taking pleasure in whipping a horse or a dog, and the same thing may be seen in a more pronounced form when a man gets pleasure from hurting or paining another person. This defect is shown in its mental aspect when a person shows contempt toward another. Even when he shows disrespect, where respect or reverence is due. Here I'm going to stop again. I won't name names, because this will be in the public venue, but I will say this. When I was at the Federation, someone who I love very much and is at the highest position within their organization, I know that it was an effort for people to show a familiarity towards this individual, a manner of being intimate. But truly, the way I saw people speak to this individual, I found it disrespectful. And I know that this is a hard thing. This was also one of the subjects that in our culture, here we are, we're on an Eastern path where the whole path is the path of discipleship, and none of us really want to be disciples. We all want to be the big boss. Well, it's really contrary to the path. Better find another path. It's not the right one for you. Because the whole inner development, the inner school, has to do with the path of realization, which ultimately relies on the path of discipleship and this interchange between student and teacher. So here we have this person who is a very outgoing person, done a lot for their organization, very warm, very loving, also doesn't expect any kind of treatment, but yet deserves it. All their hard work and energy and their efforts, their practice, their benefit to their organization. Really, if one could only think about what they say or do. Everybody wants to be buddy-buddy. That's okay. There's a time for that. Maybe that's in private. But in an outer way, it's good. You know, this teaching, remember, self-respect is shown in how we respect others. And so when Murshid says here, this defect is shown in the mental aspect when a person shows contempt towards another, or even when he shows disrespect where respect or reverence is due. Man gives pain by irony, sarcasm. We see that a lot. Cute comments that make everybody else laugh at the expense of another. Or harshness of expression. There are looks that wound. and many slight changes of manner by which it is possible to hurt another and get joy from it. When this tendency is developed in a man, a man is naturally disliked by those around him. Some show their dislike outwardly and others do not, and the man resents it only where it is expressed. Man often puts on others the blame for his own fault. This kind of ego may develop into a monster, and the soul can see this process from within and admits it to itself, though the individual may be too proud to admit it openly. The soul from within is often frightened at this monster and dreads the sight of it. And when this monster, ego, is so developed that it has created a world of pain and torture, the soul finds itself in hell. This is the only hell that exists, either here or in the hereafter, in external conditions. Even after creating the ego, man can be happy if he can break it until it becomes his friend and servant. Even after creating the ego, man can be happy if he can break it until it becomes his friend and servant. Do you all know the story of Hanuman?
Lord Hanuman? The monkey sheep.
Hanuman is the monkey. They call him the monkey god. And he is... It's a beautiful story of Lord Shiva and his wife. Oh, Sita. It's Sita and Ram. Yeah, it's Ram and Sita and Hanuman, excuse me. So it's Lord Rama and Sita and Hanuman. And when you see Hanuman, you always see him like this, with his hands at his chest, pulling his chest open. And in his heart, you see Ram, or sometimes Ram and Sita together, like this. And he's looking at, he's in ecstasy, because his heart is consumed. All that resides inside of him is his beloved, Ram and Sita. And the story, the meaning of this is, and you even see it in The Wizard of Oz, I'll get to that in a moment, but the story of that is that rising above the monkey mind, one can, with great devotion, be transformed into a perfect servant. The perfect, he's called the perfect servant of God. The perfect servant of God. And that's exactly what the ego can do. And that's exactly what this means. Even after creating the ego, man can be happy if he can break it until it becomes his friend and servant. So Hanuman also becomes this king himself in his own right and a godlike, because he has such incredible devotion. He has lost this sense of his small monkey self and become divinity itself. And he has this great capacity. You know, this is what I think our practices also can teach us. He can get very small like a flea and enter a place that he needs to, or he can get so big that he can carry the mountain with the elixir to save Lakshman. You know, he can fly in the air, you know, he can jump and he can climb and he can do all these things because he's free from this limited self. This is the beautiful teaching of Hanuman. And this we can embrace ourselves. To say, I can rise above my little monkey self and I can be, if I absorb, draw us closer to thee every moment of our life. Draw us closer to thee every moment of our life. Until in us be reflected thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, and thy peace, you see. It's all there. These prayers are very important. I can't emphasize it enough. They're complete instructions of themselves. But here's just the beautiful example of, you know, how to take take one's animal nature into. I mean, Hanuman provides us a great example for that. Great example. So imagine, you know, we see that with Jesus and Mary also in the Sacred Heart, where they're pointing to their hearts blazing, and here with the heart full of light, but the finger pointed upwards. It's that beautiful image we see like that too. The kingdom of God is within. Is that clear? Is that clear? It's not an easy teaching. There are not nice words here. Who wants to hear that we're like this? But we are. We are. And although we may not pick up a whip and hit a dog or a horse, you know what? Sometimes we even pick up that whip and we hit ourselves. That is also the ego, the self-consciousness, right? Now, one should take oneself to task, certainly. But here's the thing. You know, I've said this before. When I was a representative for Pir Vilayat of the Sufi Order International, in retreat, he would gather his leaders together and we would go into seclusion and we would go into retreat and practice and we would go through this alchemical process that I just recounted for you in complete seclusion. And he would tell us, there is no point in having regret. You must make a commitment not to do those things again. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you know, you can only say it so many times. People just don't believe it anymore. It's like the little boy that cried wolf. Yeah. But if we say, I will not do that again, then there can be real change. And Pir Vilayat would ask us to make a commitment to something within our character or personality that we wish to transform. And he would have us get on one knee, bent, and make a pledge, like a knight holding a sword, the sword that Manjushri, the deity in Buddhism, that has the sword in his hand to cut through human ignorance. And when you see the monks debate like this, and they go like this, and that's exactly that. So that's Manjushri. That is the motion of Manjushri coming down. Open the way, clear the ignorance away. So it's like with the knight and the sword, we make that pledge, and really we have to do it. You don't have to do anything. This is the path of complete spiritual liberty. You can do what as you choose. But if one really wants to take these teachings into account and use them to transform oneself, then one can take one small thing. This I will not do for the day. And I told you already, one of the things Mercy Devira had me do was fast, just to deny oneself food or water can be helpful. That, again, that tendency to want to eat, drink.
My mother used to say, I used to tell you guys that too. Don't ever, you got to think first. Don't ever do anything that you think you'll have to apologize or say, I'm sorry for.
Yeah, that's good. It's good advice.
My mom used to tell me.
That's right.
She didn't know I was
she did know all these things.
Well, she did. She had that wisdom because, you know, she always, you know, like Shakespeare and to thy own self be true. And she used to say, you're your own worst enemy. That's when you're doing your own thing, you know.
Mom's homilies had a lot of wisdom.
Yeah, my mom had all those. She used to tell me those all the time. Stop it.
She's good that way. So, let's again turn to the breath. Those lines from the prayer cartoon draw us closer to thee every moment of our lives. And you can breathe out until in us be reflected thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, and thy peace. So again, draw us closer to thee every moment of our life, or my life, until in us be reflected thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, and thy